Welcome to Talkless Water, a podcast that takes a deep dive in the world of water with those making waves. My name is Todd Bollard. I'm your host for Talkless Water. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Texas Plus Water and the Texas Water Journal. You can sign up for Texas Plus Water by visiting texasplusswater.org, and you can find the Texas Water Journal at texaswaterjournal.org. Both publications are free. My guest today is Katie Schmidt, who is the Associate Director of the National Dam Removal Program at American Rivers. Katie coordinates and implements American Rivers' federal policy agenda for dam removal and works with federal agency partners. She also supports the National Dam Removal Community of Practice and develops tools and resources for dam removal practitioners. She has focused much of her work on hydropower reform and hydropower dam removal. As a former fellow with American Rivers, Katie researched and wrote a guide to removing federally regulated hydropower dams. Katie completed her master's in environmental studies at Virginia Commonwealth University with an emphasis in hydrology and natural resources policy, aiming to remove dams to restore rivers eventually. She has worked with organizations such as American Whitewater, the American River Management Society, and the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Department before joining American Rivers. When not working, Katie can be found adventuring on the trails or on a river with her family. Katie, welcome and thank you for being part of Talkless Water.
Thank you for having me, Todd. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So I always, you know, start off with a question about, you know, your background, water, how you decided, I'm interested in water. I think I'm going to make a career on that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I would say it was a series of really fortunate events that led me to where I am today. As an undergrad, I actually found whitewater kayaking and I started paddling on rivers across the state of Virginia and throughout the Southeast. And then when I graduated, I actually moved to Western North Carolina, where I lived next to the Nantahala River and worked in the outdoor industry there. And Nantahala River is a beautiful river, but it's very regulated by hydropower. And so I had this interesting experience where the water was turning on at 9 a.m. and then turning off at 5 p.m. because of releases. And I thought to myself, oh, that's okay. Well, that's peculiar. Probably not the best for the environment, but this seems to be working for everyone here. And I continued down my road into the outdoor industry. And I found myself working for Colorado Parks and Wildlife on the Arkansas River in Salida. And I was doing a hobby project, if you will, looking at making a model of the watershed for the Arkansas River and modeling the transbasin diversions, actually, that happened up in the headwaters. So that's where they were diverting water from the western slope, putting into tunnels and pumping it underneath the Continental Divide and putting it into the Arkansas Basin so that it could be made available for folks down in Colorado Springs, I believe. And that was a really interesting, again, interesting experience of water management. And I was like, okay, I think I want to get into water management and figure out if we can make this a little bit better for the environment, because this seems to not be the best way forward. As a boater, I still, you know, got to experience a lot of work around dams and including being on rivers that had recreational releases from below hydropower projects. And so I worked a little bit with American Whitewater on hydropower reform. And like I said, that was during my master's, but I decided to go back for my master's because I wanted to do dam removal work. And what I had in the outdoor field wasn't a perfect transition into working in river restoration. So I went back, got my master's, had a wonderful opportunity to work with hydropower reform on a hydropower reform project with American Whitewater, again in the Southeast, actually, on a dewatered segment on the Hiawassee River, where a hydropower project took water out of the river, moved it 8 miles downstream, and left a 13-mile segment of the river that was dewatered.
It was bone dry?
Bone dry. There were tributaries that would bring in water, but they were only required to do 25 CFS release, so 25 cubic feet per second, in a river that normally had about 1,000 to 2,000 CFS normal flows. So it was significantly dewatered. And we were trying to advocate for more flows there. And that was a really good experience into, you know, the world of hydropower reform. And then I found this wonderful fellowship with American Rivers, where I got to join the dam removal team and work in hydropower reform and dam removal and merge those worlds together in my research on removing hydropower dams for river restoration.
Wow. Well, that's really interesting, all the things that you've done and kind of your journey. So so the Nantahala, I went to a little school not too far from Western North Carolina called Suwannee, the University of South. And one of my closest friends there was on the kayaking team. And he would always be talking about, oh, we're going to the Nantahala. And this is in the, you know, the mid 80s. And so I never could figure out what the situation was with, why was that river the place where they had all these kayaking, you know, events and all that. So you just tell me, that's why. It's a hydro dam and they were, you know, pulse flows, right? They were releasing downstream to generate some power. And so people wanted to be there so they could take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, you're mentioning also about downstream releases from hydro dams. You know, we, you know, earlier in my career, worked for a river authority. We had a big water supply reservoir that was a core reservoir, but which the water supply was controlled by the river authority. And there were all sorts of downstream interests that wanted releases from this dam during the summer. It was a bottom release dam, so the water's very cold in, you know, mm-hmm. South Texas. And so there were trout that were, you know, released there every year for trout fishing, but tubing companies and all sorts of, you know, business downstream that wanted those releases. But the people around the lake, right, who had homes and docks and all that, they didn't want the releases. And so, you know, it was a process of like working with those parties. And then, you know, the river authority had contracts for water, you know, and all that together with droughts. And, you know, it's a complicated mix of things to do for sure.
It is. I did a little bit of digging into environmental flows and how American Whitewater does environmental flow restoration that includes recreational releases, or I guess releases for recreation that also are beneficial. So trying to meet all those needs, and it is complicated, and it's complicated from coast to coast, and depending on your watershed and seasonality of change. And it's not, you know, a one size fits all for all rivers.
Right. For sure. So we know about your origin story. That's your origin story. So tell us about the work that you're doing now at American Rivers, and also tell us about your organization, American Rivers, as well.
Yeah, for sure. So I work at American Rivers. We are a national river conservation organization. So we work to protect and restore rivers across the U.S., from remote mountain streams to big urban rivers. We do that through restoration, protection, and ensuring clean water access for animals and humans. And we have a couple of different realms in that. So we do dam removal work, floodplain restoration, wild and scenic river protection. And we have a team working on access to clean water and making sure that rivers are clean, because so many of them provide drinking water for people across the country. It's really a wonderful organization full of people who are so dedicated to the work that they do and are passionate. Not all of us are boaters, but that's totally fine, because we all have our own unique stories of why we're connected to rivers and why we have a unique appreciation for them and are driven by to do our work. In my role as the associate director of the National Dam Removal Program, I get to work with a small national team to support our regional dam removal staff, and I also get to work on national priorities. So our federal policy agenda for dam removal, including working on legislation that supports dam safety and dam removal priorities. So I do get to meet with congressional offices quite a bit. I'll be up there again in 2 weeks at the Capitol Hill. And I get to work with our incredible federal agency partners who own or manage dams or otherwise have some regulation of dams. So this includes, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, the Army Corps of Engineers, the NRCS, FEMA, we've got a lot of agency partners that we work with, in helping them to go through their dam inventory and their dam removal processes so that we're making sure that dams that stay in place are safe for the public that benefits from them. And the ones that aren't safe or aren't serving a purpose anymore that are being evaluated responsibly for removal. I get to work with our community of practice, which Todd, I think, is actually how we found each other. I help with our national community of practice with practitioners who work on dam removal. So we've got hundreds of folks that are working across the country and a few that are abroad as well.
So the movement to remove dams, seems to have really taken off in the last 10 to 20 years. And, I'm curious, what are the primary reasons that dams are being removed at this point? And I'm also kind of curious, are we close to, or maybe have we reached the point where we're like, we're moving more dams than we're building?
I think we are to the point where we're removing more than we're building. I think all the quote unquote good spots have already been taken for dam placement. But we're definitely increasing the numbers that are getting removed. We've got this excellent graph that I can share with you later of seeing the trend of it going over the years. But most dams are actually removed for ecological benefit. We've got about 70% at least that are removed for habitat restoration, for fish and aquatic organism passage, for water quality improvement. So some type of environmental benefit. Of those, plenty are also removed for additional reasons. So very few dams are removed for one reason. Ecology is the primary driver, but we also see a lot of ones for economics, especially in the realm of hydropower, where smaller projects are marginally economic. It makes more sense to remove them than to continue operating at a loss. But others are unsafe. We've got a national inventory of dams that has shown that most dams are around they're 65 years old. So most of them are at or past their expected lifespan. And so they're aging structures that are continuing to deteriorate naturally in the rivers, which make them more of a safety hazard. So while right now only about a third of dams are removed for safety, we're seeing that number increasing and people realizing that, okay, if we're not using it anymore, let's go ahead and take it out so that we don't have this be a failure that's going to have unintended fatal consequences with its failure in the next big storm.
Gosh. So, when we're talking about dam removals, I think sometimes people think of like Hoover Dam. Is that what you're talking about? But most of these dams are small earthen dams, it seems like. And I'm just curious, do we have a good estimate of how many dams exist in the U.S.? And actually, I don't know if most dams are small earthen dams. I don't know if that's mostly what's being removed. That's two things possibly, but I'm curious about that. And do we know how many dams there are? I mean, that seems like an easy question, but probably isn't.
You hit it right on the nose. It seems like it should be an easy question. And we're working on it. So the National Inventory of Dams is the inventory that most folks know. We call it the NID. It's operated by the Army Corps of Engineers, and they basically take information from states and other dam owners and put it together in this incredible data set. It gets better by the year. I'm not kidding. I'm on it almost daily, pulling out data because you can sort it by watershed, state, congressional district, whatever you need. They've got it there. And then they've got lots of detailed information on the dam itself. That database has 91,827 dams. If folks need a little bit of clarification on what this number means, that's basically like building a dam a day since we adopted the Declaration of Independence. A dam a day. Wow. But that's not all dams. So you need to meet a certain threshold to get in the inventory of dams. And so a partner in the Southeast Aquatic Resources Partnership, they started developing a data set of all the dams. So including the NID, but all the dams. And so these are more like your smaller earthen structures, your farm pond dams, and all the ones that are not in the NID. She's not done yet. She's already found
429
dams.
Oh my God. So over 500,000. Mm-hmm. And so when you say she's not done yet, is she like halfway done, or I mean, you think this is going to be a million, or what? Any guesses?
I was looking at the map the other day, and it looks like the contiguous United States is almost done, and that they're starting to work on Alaska. And I say okay. She is Kat Hanke. I have to give her credit. She's been amazing. You guys can see this data set on aquaticbarriers.org. She started this, and she's now got a team. She's got support from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do this, and they're expanding their work into Alaska. And then I think Hawaii's next on the docket to make sure that they're collecting all the data on the dams. But so it's nearly complete, but it's not there yet.
And, so over half a million, you know, for the 48 contiguous states with Alaska and Hawaii to go.
Yes.
Wow. Interesting. Well, you know, I knew that the number would be big because of all the, you know, soil conservation dams and, you know, farm ponds and things, but, you know, didn't really know what the magnitude of it would be.
Yeah. It's quite significant. That's like building 5.5 dams per day since 1776, which is wild if you think about it. That's so much work.
Right.
But you did ask Todd, what they're mostly made out of.
Yeah.
And it is all over. So there are a lot of small earthen dams, but so many are made out of concrete. Some older ones are made out of stone. There's just all sorts of designs and styles and materials for the dams. But there's the ones that are getting made these days are mostly concrete, but they're few and far between in the United States. Abroad, that's a whole different story.
Yeah, we'll get to abroad, I think, right at the end here, because I'm interested in that, too. So the size that is, you know, most likely to be removed or, you know, for a certain purpose, the dam was constructed. What do you see kind of in the trend there that here are the ones that seem to be, you know, the subject of dam removal projects most often?
Yeah, the biggest one is 210 feet tall. So we've removed big dams. And the biggest dam removal project in history is happening right now on the Klamath River, as you know. Mm-hmm. But the average size of dams that have been removed is about 15 feet. Usually we're looking at smaller projects. So when people hear, the Klamath River dam removal project, that's been 20 plus years in the making. It has, because it's a massive project. It's a massive undertaking. But most dam removals are not only not hydropower dams, which adds many years in and of itself, but most dams are smaller and not as complex. So we can get them out faster in a shorter timeline. The types of dams that are being removed, the purpose that they served is all over the board. You name a subject that a dam has been served or that a dam was used for, and it has probably been removed. We've seen recreation. We've seen water supply, hydropower. A lot of old mill dams. I think that probably makes up the bulk because that makes up the bulk of the dams that are out there. The mills were used. And then when the mill shut down, nobody went back and took out the dam. So they just stay there. And we're seeing this across the Northeast, especially as a big problem, because it's not only blocking fish passage, but some of those dams are so old that people don't know who the owner is. Mm, and so you've got this aging, unsafe structure that's not maintained. Nobody knows who owns it. Just sitting in the water.
Right. Right. And I imagine at some point something goes wrong with the dam and everybody's trying to figure out, who's responsible for fixing it. And maybe that'll lead to a removal project or something.
Yeah. Hopefully for the ones that aren't needed. Yeah.
So how many have been removed? Do we know how many have been removed over so many years? You got an estimate for us on that?
I have some estimate numbers. I would say they're more precise than an estimate. My colleague, Jessie Thomas-Blate, actually at American Rivers, she manages the dam removal database. We annually collect dam removal data from partners across the country. And she's the one who goes through all this data, cleans it up, puts it into this public data set that's available on Figshare. And we have a total of 2,119 dams that have been removed, 80 last year alone. Wow. So we saw a dip in dam removals around COVID, but we're seeing it start to rebound and come back up. So we know 2,119 at least have been removed, and most of those have been in the last 25 years.
What was the record year? I mean, how many were moved in, I guess, the record year? Do you know that?
Oh, I don't have, I just actually closed that spreadsheet, but I think it was 2019 with over 100 dams.
Gotcha. Yep. And so you see that you know, rate of dam removals is going to get back to where it was in 2019 and keep rising? Is that what everybody is anticipating?
That is, yeah. So we're seeing it increase. We're seeing the expertise increase, engineering firms that are able to do the design plans and construction for this. Those are increasing in number. There's including to an increase in dam owners who want to do removal. Dam removal does not happen without the owner being on board. That's the first and foremost thing. You need dam owner consent. And we're seeing more and more that dam owners are reaching out to us at American Rivers. They're reaching out to our partners at the Nature Conservancy and Trout Unlimited to say, hey, we've got this structure. We would like to remove it, but we're not sure where to start. Can you help us? And so it's been really interesting to see that trend of dam owners reach out to us. I will say, as an organization, though, we've also made the goal to see 30,000 dams removed by 2050. So we would like...
How many, again?
30,000.
30,000 by 2050.
Yeah.
And we're 2,100?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I love optimism. That's great.
Shy of 28,000 to go.
There you go. We got to get a head start on it.
Yeah. About it, though, with 530,000 out there, this is, I think, less than 6% of the dams, or less than 6%, 90,000. Anyway, it's not a ton of dams when you really think about it as far as the big number of how many dams are out there. But we really see this as necessary to address climate change and the biodiversity crisis that we're seeing in the country.
So you said that some landowners will actually contact you all now, or the Nature Conservancy, and say, hey, you know, I would like to remove this dam. Are there funds that you have access to, or that you know are available that you can help the landowner with? Is that one of the reasons why they're contacting you? Not only the expertise, but also it's probably very expensive, right? And so they're trying to find some ways to help pay for it.
Yeah, that is a little bit of it, to be honest. And in an ideal world, the dam owner pays for it. They're the ones who reap the benefits of the dam, and they're the ones who should pay for dam removal. But that's not reality. So we do help them find funds. There's state and federal funding out there. There's private grants that are available from foundations, and sometimes donors are willing to fund a project, especially if it's on a favorite river with some good fishing. I'm only partially joking about that one, but there's a lot of funding out there, and you can get creative with it. The bipartisan infrastructure law, when that was passed, we actually had an influx of $800 million that was made available for dam removal. And so that was through NOAA, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers, U.S. Forest Service, and FEMA. If y'all want all five. But we worked with our partners to help push for that $800 million in the bipartisan infrastructure law. And we also advocated for $800 million to go to dam safety and nearly $100 million to go to hydropower retrofits for environmental and safety upgrades.
So $800 million sounds like a lot of money, but I can imagine that there are probably some removal projects that are really, really expensive. And I'm just kind of thinking, I wonder how many you can actually remove for that amount. I mean, I know that it's going to be so variable between projects because of the size and number of other reasons, but how far into your 50,000 goal is that money going to get you?
That's a good question.
It's 30,000, right?
30,000, yeah.
30,000. I really upped it on you there. Yeah, 30,000.
You did. 30,000 by the year 2050. And the funding, it depends on the dam removals. I don't have this at the tip of my tongue, but I think there's about 100 projects that have already been funded. The funding is also available to really anything that restores fish passage by removing barriers. So we've seen a lot of culvert restoration projects happen as well through this. But it depends on your project and the funding that is required for that. So if you have just a smaller dam and there's nothing that is complicated about it, you have no infrastructure that needs to be addressed, you have no endangered species, and you don't have sediment contamination, which honestly is the majority of projects, so they don't have one of those three. It could be a dam removal for maybe $1 million or less, yep. Right? So yeah. If we were to take the $800 million and put it towards all of that, like we could see 100 dams removed. That's not how it's breaking out, right? They're a couple of years into the funding allocation, but there's a lot of funding through the bill, and then there's additional funding available at state levels. And actually, Fish and Wildlife Service put together this interagency fish passage task force, and they worked on this hub. They call it the Fish Passage Portal, where people can go onto this portal. And it's a website where they can find any dam removal funding for fish passage. And some of it is available for dam removal. And we also have sources on our website too, for folks to find state dam removal funds.
Great. So which states are most active? I know there's not really a whole lot going on in Texas, but I'm sure there are probably some hot spots. And I'm kind of curious, you have regional offices. Are they kind of located in those areas where you're seeing a lot of activity?
Not necessarily. We have somebody in Pennsylvania, and we have folks in California, but they're not necessarily because of that. Pennsylvania is the leader of dam removal. They've removed 390 dams across the state. California is next with 184, so less than half of what Pennsylvania has done. And Pennsylvania essentially went through and they upped their dam safety regulations. And a lot of projects were found to be, they weren't up to snuff, if you will. And there was funding made available for dam removal, and the permitting was made easier to remove those unsafe structures and promote environmental restoration. So they really essentially made the process a lot easier to do dam removals. Hmm. I will say that our staff in Pennsylvania has been very busy and has led the dam removal work in all that she does in Pennsylvania and surrounding states. Lisa Hollingsworth-Segedy actually has removed over 100 dams.
Wow.
She's managed over 100 dam removals by herself. She's worked with partners on them, but as the primary project manager, she has been cranking them out and continues to do so. I think she has 17 active projects right now that she's working on.
Good gosh. Tell us her name again.
Lisa Hollingsworth-Segedy. She deserves a gold medal and a homemade pie.
Right. Well, she might be a good person to talk to some in the future about all that. So, I never would have thought Pennsylvania would have been the leader, but if they have a program looking at dam liability and all that, makes sense that they would have a systematic approach to addressing issues with dams that are maybe not sound or having some maintenance problems. I imagine for each one of these projects, except for the ones you mentioned that were like a culvert or something where there's no ESA issues or sediment problems or anything like that. But most of them, I imagine there's a whole lot of work that's got to go in before the dam can be removed. And particularly, the ones that you're talking about on the Klamath. I imagine that was a multi-year process, but kind of tell us what happens typically before you get to the point where you're out there with a what would it be? It's not a bulldozer, but it's a backhoe or something, right?
Yeah.
Out of the river. Yeah. What typically happens prior to that point?
Almost all the work is leading up to that point. It's a lot of preparation. And do you start with dam owner consent? Like I said, a lot of that is the dam owners coming to folks asking for help. But sometimes it's you reaching out to the dam owner and saying, hey, have you considered removing this project if it's not serving its purpose anymore, if you don't need it? We see a lot of unsafe dams be removed like this. We see a lot of uneconomic dams, especially in the hydropower realm, where you've got something that's not generating power or not generating power sufficiently. And the cost to upgrade and maintain the facility is just not worth it. So they turn to removal. So start with dam owner consent. And then from there, you move into from the project manager's side. You're generally speaking, you're looking for funding. You need to work with an engineering firm to get the designs drafted and approved, securing permits for this. You're working with state and federal agencies, sometimes tribes, and sometimes stakeholders. Oftentimes, dam removals include a big community engagement and education component, especially if there are folks who live along the reservoir. It's important that they understand what's happening and can be informed in the process so that they know what to expect. A lot of dams have been removed where there have been lakefront homes. And it's not that they're losing like everything. They're losing the lake, yes, but then they're getting this restored free-flowing river, which they then have access to. So that's a big one that can take a lot of time, actually, to have those individual conversations and those town hall meetings and just open houses where people can come and talk. Lots of meetings to make sure everybody's on the same page discussing the project and next steps. But really the design and construction and permitting and those are all parts of it. Once everything is approved, then you have to figure out seasonality when you can go. So different parts of the country have different timing for when they do dam removal based on the impacted species. So the Klamath, they're going in and they're taking care of this right now. Or I guess it's April. So they've been doing a lot of work already because they want to avoid the spawning season for salmon. Others, especially in the Southeast, we see sometimes dam removal happen in late summer when the water levels are really low and you're not necessarily impacting as many species, but they're all really specific. So other things that might have to go into it are site analysis and sediment testing and making sure that there are no contaminants in the sediment. So there's a lot of data gathering and data analysis and planning, right? Measure 5 times, cut once, if you will, to make sure that we're doing it right. And we've over 2,000 dams have been removed. So there's a lot of experience out there. There's a lot of expertise. This is no longer, you know, monkey wrench gang radical. It's not like people are just throwing explosives at dams. Honestly, most dams don't even include explosives because they're not very efficient at taking out a bunch of concrete at once in a way that you can then take that concrete out of the river and get it out. Right.
So,
yeah, you need to be very controlled. You usually got somebody out there with a backhoe or jackhammer and just taking it out chunk by chunk and removing it.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I imagine, you know, people see a whole lot more value in having a river where people can paddle down and fish and, you know, have anadromous fish, you know, come up and have access to. And the public view is different maybe than it used to be when, there wasn't a whole lot of folks across the country spending a lot of time on rivers other than, you know, the big storied rivers, right? But now, you know, people spend time on rivers wherever they live. And I imagine that's resulted in some, you know, some kind of reevaluation about rivers and their future and their value. Because, you know, there's a big recreational value. And I'm sure that some of those communities are like interested and seeing that be kind of a, you know, part of the mix of things going on where they are, right?
Yeah, that's another factor into the decision making. For the free flowing rivers, you have a tourism industry that can build up around it. On the Kennebec River, actually, there was the removal of the Edwards Dam in 1999, which actually was one of the big tipping points of the dam removal movement, because this was a big old hydropower dam that was removed. It was pretty contentious, but the license got transferred and the state surrendered the license and removed it. So, but that removal and the restoration of the river gave the community an opportunity to reconnect with it. They started seeing a return of the sturgeon and other fish species that hadn't been able to get up there for so many years. And there are even restaurants that have built up along the banks of the river. And one of them has a logo that has a jumping sturgeon. And you would not have seen that before dam removal because people turned away from the river. It was used for industry. It didn't smell great. It was stagnant. It was not full of fish that were swimming up and downstream the way they needed to be. So we've seen these communities rebuild back up, both in their relationship with the river and the tourism industry that can come with that.
What state or states was that dam in?
Oh, yeah. That was in Maine.
Mm-hmm. Maine. Okay.
The Kennebec River in Maine.
Gotcha. So it sounds like a lot of the removals are... I mean, they're almost kind of target of opportunity type thing, you know, a landowner or who our owner, hey, doesn't really want to keep the dam anymore, or there's maybe a big Endangered Species Act issue some other liability issue. Is there any kind of, process or tool for, taking a look at dams and determining, hey, these are the dams that should be prioritized, when money is available, any effort like that?
Yes, there is. It's actually back to SARP, the Southeast Aquatic Resources Partnership, at aquaticbarriers.org, and they have a prioritization tool on there. So that 533,000 dams that they put out, they have taken that and they've put together a tool where you can analyze, who owns the dam, what are the impacts of the dam? What species are impacted? If you were to remove it, how many river miles would you open up? Which species would benefit from this? And there's some community factors as well. So there's a lot of data that you can pull into that. And you can say, I'm working in this state, I'm working in this watershed, or I want to open up this many river miles or target this species. So there's all that, but you can also target unsafe dams. So the safety categories are... The hazard classification is high hazard potential, means that if that dam fails, it's going to kill someone. It's likely to kill someone. Significant is if the dam fails, it's going to have significant economic impacts. So higher significant hazard, you can look at those. And then you can look at the condition rating too, to see like, are these being maintained? Are they in a good condition or not? Because if they're not, they're in poor and satisfactory condition, then maybe there's not funding to upkeep them, and maybe they're not being maintained in a way that is safe for the community. So removal could be considered. So there's all these factors that you can put in with this data set that SARP has come up with and use them to prioritize dams for removal. One of the questions that I like to have people start with is, what's its intended purpose? Like once you get down to the project itself, is like, is it actually meeting its intended purpose? Okay, if not, like, what is it being used for, if it's being used at all? Do these people have does the dam owner have funds to be able to maintain the structure and keep it safe? Safety is a big thing. I didn't realize how much dam safety was going to play into my work, but it's a significant factor because we're seeing this aging infrastructure that's really expensive to maintain, let alone upgrade. And for projects that aren't needed, we're seeing more and more people turn to removal as an option instead of keeping that unsafe structure in place.
So I've got two questions before you go on. One is there like a dam that is rated like the biggest ecological benefit would be removal of this dam? Is that how it's like done? Or I'm just curious about that. I mean, you have to wonder, hey, if there's an assessment, I wonder if, it says, hey, this dam was removed, it's the biggest impact in terms of the environment of any other dam, something like that.
There is ranking on that. Yeah. So depending on what you plug in, it'll come out like, here are your top tier dams that would be good for meeting this for removal. They've also been able to, not with all the dams, but for a lot, they've been able to do an assessment on whether or not a feasibility assessment, really, really basic, right? They didn't go through this for everyone, but a feasibility assessment on whether or not the dam would be easy to remove. So this could be talking to the dam owner, the current dam's use, the amount of people who are living along the reservoir. So there's a couple different factors in there. Like, is this feasible to remove right now? Or do you have, you know, a massive dam with hundreds of homes around it that is not going anywhere soon? That's a hydropower project that's actually maintained and is safe and is actually generating power for those hundreds of homes that are around the lake.
Huh.
Yeah.
I wonder if there are a significant percentage of dams where you can't really identify who owns it at this point. I mean, it's been there for a long time and somebody built it and they're gone, or the company is gone, or whatever. I mean, I'm just curious, any, you know, kind of guess or idea about how many dams we might put in the classification of not sure who's responsible for it?
I don't have a number, but it's not small.
Oh, okay.
It's my understanding. It's not crazy, right? Like, it's not 100,000 dams, but it's higher than it should be, right? Every dam should have an owner. Every dam should have somebody who is responsible for it. But we're seeing this in every state where they don't know who the owner is, or they did know when they passed away, and there's something going on with who inherits the dam when they pass mm-hmm. away, especially if it's a privately owned dams. We're seeing that across the board, but I don't have numbers on those yet. But, you know, again, in that ideal pie in the sky world, those would be the first to come out. If no one's has ownership, then does anyone have a really need for them?
Right, right. So is there any effort to kind of track and measure the benefits resulting from the removal of specific dams? I mean, so that we can kind of quantify, hey, you know, this dam was removed, and we can see this benefit in terms of native fish or endangered species or tourism or whatever.
Yeah, there is a lot of research that's being done on dams, but it does vary depending on funding that's available. Most dams have a monitoring time of, you know, 1 to 3 years after the project, and then there's not always a lot of funding to do continuous studies of that. But we have our data set on all the dams that have been removed, and then the Dam Removal Information Portal, which is done in partnership between American Rivers and the USGS. That is a portal where you can find all the research that has been submitted and articles on dam removal. So the DRIP portal, that's redundant. DRIP is a great resource for folks who want some more information and to have that research. But again, it is a little bit more siloed because each are project specific, but though there's been a couple papers that come out and they've done more broader analysis taking in that information, there's still this gap, though, in funding to be able to do that long-term research. Like, even the Elwha River up in the on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington, they have one of the longest studies, right? 10 to 20 years, they want to continue evaluating the river after dam removal. And that is wonderful. And they're able to still to continue that research, but there's still a lot of funding that needs to go into this so that the research can continue to do the good work and continue to publish that data as they're collecting it.
So is this, you know, really a U.S. movement at this point, or do you see this happening all over the world? You know, anybody who listens to this podcast, they hear my old war stories like every month. And, you know, they're like, he's going to tell this one again. But, what was curious, what I'm thinking about is I was in China in 2019 at a conference, you know, speaking at that conference. And, you know, most of the other speakers were about talking about the dams we're building, right? Hey, we're building this dam, we're going to build that dam. And, you know, that reflected kind of the thinking in China and India and Bangladesh, that's where most of the people who were speaking and who were involved in the conference were from. And so I'm just kind of curious, you know, is this a movement just confined to the United States, or maybe United States and Europe, or is it one that you see kind of spreading to other parts of the world?
That is a great question. We're hoping it spreads more. Europe has its own Dam Removal Europe, which is an organization that works in collaboration with the World Fish Migration Day, which is coming up at the end of May to celebrate. Mark your calendars, May 25th. And
World Fish Migration Day.
Fish Migration Day. Yeah. And
that's a new one for me, but it sounds great.
It is. It's a celebration of fish and fish moving, specifically fish moving in rivers that don't have dams that are preventing them from being able to move. Mm. This year's theme is actually free flow, to reflect that of just, hey, let's take out dams that are not needed so that we can promote fish passage. And Dam Removal Europe has been working to support and promote dam removal work throughout Europe and abroad too. Lisa's actually, I think, on their advisory board, the woman I mentioned earlier, who's removed over 100 dams on her own, works closely with Dam Removal Europe. And I got to meet Herman, the head of Dam Removal Europe, earlier last month. We all actually went on a trip to the Elwha together, which was really special to go see the restoration done there.
Nice.
Just before that, we were at the World Fisheries Congress in Seattle, which was a wonderful place to meet so many folks doing work for fisheries, including dam removal. And I met this incredible woman who's doing work to support dam removal in India. They're not removing dams yet, but she's working on trying to support that research and evaluating structures for whether or not they're needed, and trying to promote removing ones that aren't needed anymore and that are causing more harm than they are doing good. There's still an issue of dams being built in other places, but it gets really complicated because they're trying to be built for water supply and for hydropower. But you're doing that sometimes at the expense of the communities that were upstream of what is now an inundated reservoir. And you're disrupting the fish passage and the natural migration and the natural flooding that helps promote soil fertility. So it's really, really complicated. In
right.
many other places.
Right. I know there was certainly an element of political power in the construction of dams, and there were, great points of pride, in terms of, technical and economic capacity early on in the United States in particular. And I think that still exists in other parts of the world. And, when you have multiple nations sharing a river and they're not always getting along, it's a big issue. When somebody upstream is building a dam and, a nation downstream doesn't have a whole lot of say over it, and it's going to impact, obviously, their use of specific river. And so those issues become pretty fraught. And I think the one on the Nile is a pretty good example of how that can really raise tensions between nations as well.
Yeah, I agree.
So we're all the way to the final question. Can you believe that?
Oh, my goodness.
So you've hinted at these, but let's talk about these more specifically. My final question is, how can listeners learn more about dam removals? And you've named a number of websites and sources. Why don't we try to go back through some of those? Your practitioner's hub, tell us about that first.
Sure. Yeah. So we have a community of practice for dam removal practitioners, and you can find a lot of resources on our website. Sometimes it's easier to Google what you're looking for, American Rivers, and then whatever you want, dam removal funding, it'll find this place for you. But if you are a dam removal practitioner and you are interested in joining the community of practice, you should reach out. You can also look at our webpage on americanrivers.org/dam removal COP. That stands for community of practice. And if you're new to dam removals, try to find one that's close to you. There's been over 2,000, so there might be one close to you. You can check out our dam removal map. Again, americanrivers.org/dam removal map. And that has a map of all the dams that have been removed. Go out, check out the site. You're going to see a river. You'll see a free-flowing river. And maybe there'll be some type of interpretive sign, but I think it's really important that people are able to see that, once the dam is gone, have this beautiful restored area that's back to its natural state. A couple of the other tools that I mentioned were the SARP database. So that's the aquaticbarriers.org. And then the National Inventory of Dams, which is like NID.USA's Army something. So just look up National Inventory of Dams. And then the Dam Removal Information Portal is another great resource for those looking for academic papers and the research that's happened on dam removals.
Great stuff. And
the last one. Before I forget, the Fish Passage Portal. That's the portal you were talking about. The Interagency Fish Passage Portal is... it's just the Fish Passage Portal. It's the Interagency Fish Passage Task Force that has the Fish Passage Portal. Let's see how many times I can say Fish Passage in a single sentence.
That's the record for this podcast, by the way.
Is it? Yeah. Once we get Lisa on, she'll wrap it up.
She might exceed that. Well, you've also got some great webinars on your website, too.
Thank you. I had
the chance to listen live to the last one. And you're going to post those so people can continue to go back and listen to them. But you've had two this year, I think, something like that.
We've had three this year, actually. Okay. And then I'm hosting our third on the federal policy agenda in 2 weeks. So, and the recordings of the three already are on our community of practice webpage. So that first one, Dam Removal COP. And folks can see the recordings there. And that's where I'm going to continue to post more information and resources for our practitioners and folks interested in learning more about dam removal.
Great. Katie, thank you for joining us today. I really, really have enjoyed this.
Of course. Thank you, Todd. This was fun.
Well, and you did a great job. And so it's always fun when the recording works out well and the host doesn't mess up the question or the host's dog and come in his office and start barking or something. all things have happened in the past. So it was great fun and I learned a lot. And I know that people listening will learn a lot. So thanks again.
Of course. I hope it's helpful. So I appreciate the opportunity.
This has been Talk Plus Water. My guest today was Katie Schmidt, who is the Associate Director of the National Dam Removal Program at American Rivers. I want to thank you, the listener, for spending your valuable time listening to Talk Plus Water. And I want to thank Anna Huff at the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University for getting every episode ready to go. My name is Todd Butler, and this has been Talk Plus Water. Let's talk water again soon.